Welcome back to the Stoa podcast. So I think what I'm going to do is upload a podcast episode every day. And the idea is to upload a lot of the Stoa sessions that we've been having for the last 5 months. And there's about 50 plus videos that would be pretty good to have up here on the podcast. So if you haven't listened or sat in those videos or watched them on YouTube, you can listen to them here. So yeah, I think I'll do that one a day. That seems ambitious, but you know, what's a man without ambition? And today we have Daniel Schmachtenberger. So Daniel visited the Stoa on Monday, do a talk on metamodern Stoicism. And, you know, we had over 150 people in the Zoom call. There's a lot of aliveness there. It's very exciting. It actually felt like this is what the Stoa should be. So it was a great conversation, some great questions, great answers from Daniel. So yeah, this is going to be that session. Daniel's coming back to the Stoa on next Monday. What's that date? Let me get that date for you. Yeah, so he's doing a talk on his Dharma inquiry questions. So he has a series of questions that kind of tease out what your basically life purpose should be. And that's going to be on Monday, August 31st, 2020, at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can RSVP on the website. And Daniel's also agreed to be a sense maker in residence at the Stoa for either the month of September or October, and it's going to be called the Digital Porch. And for those of you in the know, the Stoa, the original Stoa, Pokeli, used to be called, or was translated to the Painted Porch. That's where the original Stoics got their name, because they hung out at the Stoa Pokeli, so they called them the Stoics. So it's sort of a riff on that, and we're going to call this the Digital Porch. So that should be really cool. And we have a lot of other sense maker in residence at the Stoa. And so this is a four-part series, four sessions over 4 weeks during a month. We currently have John Robb doing network tribalism. John was a former counterterrorism specialist for the U.S. military. He's a military analyst and author. He has his last session on Monday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. Then Zach Stein is going to come and take his place for September on metapsychology. And we got also Dave Snowden, Peter Wang, Benita Roy, a lot of interesting people coming in to be a sense maker in residence of the Stoa. So go on the website, thestoa.ca, check that out, check out the Wisdom Gym. We have about 20 upcoming events, lots of excitement happening at the Stoa. If you would like to support the Stoa, we could definitely use your support. We've been hosting over 300 plus events since COVID happened, all for free. We'd like to continue to do so. We're providing massive amount of value for people. And if you actually attend the sessions, especially the reoccurring sessions, the ones that are not recorded, they're quite special. You get to create that feeling of intimacy, community, or communitas is the buzzword that people in our space like to use. So yeah, visit the Stoa. And visit the in-person Stoa, because that's when you really get a feel and sense of it. So you can support us on the Patreon. I'll put the Patreon website in the show notes as well. So that being said, enjoy this session we had with Daniel Schmachtenberger.
The Stoa is a digital campfire where we cohere in dialogue about what matters most at the knife's edge of what's happening now.
So when you suggested you want to talk about Stoicism, your kind of take on it and what you see, what's representing Stoicism, and maybe kind of have a metamodern or developmental lens, what kind of sparked that? I guess just maybe just riff or free associate on your thoughts in that area.
I think I'd be curious if I could know a little bit more about for this group of people that are assembling here at a place called the Stoa, what in terms of Stoicism is familiar and kind of shared, and also in terms of metamodernism, so I can have a sense of how to relate.
So I can kind of speak on the behalf of maybe the Stoa group or the regulars. But in the meantime, there's a lot of faces I don't recognize here, so you can drop them in the chat box. Just say what your familiarity with Stoicism or metamodernism. I would say that more people, at least the regulars, are more familiar with metamodernism. There's book clubs on, you know, Hanzi's book and stuff like that, than they are with Stoicism. Because we hardly have any events on Stoicism here. It's sort of like a space that's stewarded by a Stoic, but we don't really talk about Stoicism. And I don't know how sophisticated the understanding is of metamodernism. As you can see from the chats, there's a bunch of people already dropping down. They're familiar with metamodernism. But I also imagine there's some people that are just coming in that might have heard the terms but don't know much about it. So you probably have a mixed bag of understanding here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm definitely not a scholar of ancient Stoic philosophy. There's a number of Stoic philosophers that I have read and appreciated. I actually read them later in life. I grew up more on Eastern philosophic traditions and got into the Western traditions later. But when you're studying Vedanta or Buddhism, there are ideas that are very similar to Stoic ideas. There's some things that are quite different, but some things that are similar in terms of what is virtue, how do you cultivate it, how do you cultivate increased strength and resilience of character under adversity, how do you become at peace with death, and those types of things. And the actual word Stoic, I didn't even know there was a Greek tradition until I was a bit later, and the way that I heard it was actually a very kind of simple cartoonish version that I think a lot of people have heard that just meant like have a stiff upper lip and don't show emotions. There was something as I got into psychotherapy in that community was actually completely rejected as this is a way to fragment yourself and spiritually bypass and repress emotionality and emotional intelligence. And so I think it's very important in this way when we talk about metamodern Stoicism. If you read Marcus Aurelius or Seneca or whatever, they're not just saying that simplistic, keep a stiff lip there. They're inquiring into how do we relate with our emotions and our desires and our thoughts in a way that moves us in the direction of what is meaningful and what is fundamentally meaningful. And so specifically the idea that there is this relationship between logic and virtue. And so it was both epistemology, how do we do better, clear thinking about the nature of ourself and reality in the world, and how do we cultivate the qualities of virtue in ourselves and the positive relationship between those? So the idea that the true, the good, and the beautiful were actually facets of an integrated reality was a emerging from an intuition of an integrated metaphysics. And I think that's actually something distinctly different in the Greek Enlightenment than in the later European Enlightenment. Is in the later European Enlightenment, not as much early in the Renaissance, but later, the epistemology section, which got reified with the methods of science, became very much about what is, but in a way that was seen as fundamentally incommensurable with what ought. And now, of course, lots of people had a sense of an ethics, whether it was the founding fathers being deistic while being focused on science. But ultimately, the philosophy of science grounds itself in repeatable measurements. We measure something, we repeat the measurements, we come up with predictions based on the hypothesis. And so science formally exists within to study the objective in the domain of the simultaneously measurable and repeatable. And that gives is, but ought doesn't exist there. You have to make some value statements about what, if we, okay, a measure can show, are we moving towards or away from, but what should be, which is why the philosophy of science by itself tends to orient in a nihilistic direction. Big Bang happened because who knows why, no particular reason, random combinatorics, et cetera. And I think we can actually see a lot of the problems in the world through the lens of the is-ought distinction, where science has become an incredibly powerful epistemology for studying what is objectively that can then be applied via technology to changing what is, right? And obviously, if my choices are leveraged by intercontinental ballistic missiles as opposed to arrows. It's a much more powerful leverage to be able to change reality. But then there's this question of, well, what are we applying the technology towards? What is the world that we actually want? What is worth wanting? And science's opinion is we formally have no opinion on that. And any position on that is equally ungrounded because it's not emerging from something that the methods of science themselves can validate. And so then, well, what ends up funding the research is what's going to have return on investment. So basically capital returns and more generally game theory ends up being the thing. So then the nihilism of social Darwinism becomes the, because good basically becomes what wins at game theory. And that's a very, not only superficial, but eventually self-terminating definition of good. So, yeah, when I think about Stoicism, I think about deep contemplation on what is actually good, what is desirable, what's worth desiring, basically a reified ethics and a reified epistemology. And is there a unified metaphysics from which those can both arise as a basis of how do we do choice making? And ultimately, that's the thing, is how to inform human choice towards an effective life individually and collectively at different scales. Something that I'm focused on a lot right now is the collective scale. Since the beginning of what we call civilization, like early Egypt, Sumeria, whatever, a tiny percentage of all the people that have ever lived, lived in democracies or republics, lived in a system that had any kind of participatory governance. Almost everybody lived under feudalism or monarchy or some kind of autocratic control. And the few times that democracies or republics occurred, they occurred following a cultural enlightenment. And it was a cultural enlightenment that had to do a couple things. It had to do something in both is and ought, and specifically in the is space, it had to get objective and intersubjective. So I'll say what I mean by that. We see the Athenian democracy coming out of kind of a Greek enlightenment. And the Greek enlightenment was everybody should learn logic and learn history and learn math and learn rhetoric and learn the arts. And if you have a high value on education where everyone can assess base reality on their own, not just say what someone else said because, you know, the great authority in the past said it, but everyone can actually assess base reality on their own, then you have the unifying nature of reality itself. And the other key part was the Socratic method, the Socratic dialectic, where everyone could take everyone else's perspective and position. In the European Enlightenment later, it was the Hegelian dialectic and the kind of methods of science. But if everyone can assess base reality on their own and they can take each other's perspective, they end up being like, we don't need rulers. We can actually have conversations and be able to bring about self-governance. But there also did have to be a shared culture. They all emerged, that cultural enlightenment valued those things, right? And it also had some other ideas of what is good that it valued. Same with the founding of this country. And notice I got some feedback. All right. And so most everyone can sense that the U.S. has been undergoing radical decay, and it feels like it's kind of near the end of the republic being much of anything. And democracy's never made it past 300 years. We're at 250 years currently.
Good idea.
I think it'd be good if everybody was on mute.
Yeah, I'm just going to force everyone on mute, and then I'm going to ask you to unmute yourself. There you go.
All right. And so the cultural enlightenment, I'm going a bit off topic, but it tells you how I'm thinking about it. George Washington in the founding of this country said that the number one goal of government should be the comprehensive education of every citizen and what he called the science of government. Basically, everyone needed educated about how humans work and how human coordination works well enough that they can really participate. And Jefferson said, if I could have perfect news and a broken government or perfect government and broken news, I'd take perfect news. Because if people understand the world they live in, they can overthrow the corrupt government and make sense of things and coordinate. But I think the key thing there is that collective choice making requires collective sense making and collective perspective taking. I have to be able to understand how other people are seeing things to then be able to work on strategies that are effective together. So I think either kind of the decay that's happened in the US and other places continues, and many areas of the world have already moved back to more autocratic governance. We see that happening in Brazil and Venezuela and Turkey and all over. We see it's already happened largely in Russia and China. If we want something other than autocracy, and autocracy is easier because it's easier for a small number of people at the top to coordinate than for a large number of people to coordinate. And I actually don't think it's possible for a very large number of people to coordinate without something like an enlightenment at the basis, where those people can all actually make sense of reality well. They can regulate their emotions enough that they're not just being limbically hijacked, and they can take each other's perspectives and do higher order synthesis. And so, now when we come to the concept of metamodern, so there was kind of the Greek Enlightenment could be thought of as a pre-modern enlightenment. We could think of the European Enlightenment as modernity. And it was an epistemology of that allowed us to actually produce and build things better, right? Newton's calculus caught on, not because people aesthetically liked it, but because it aimed cannons much better than pendulum dowsing did. So those who took it on actually game theoretically won. So modernity brought the capacity to build the world, but it also brought the ability to destroy environments and oppress the world more effectively. So then postmodernism, of course, was a bunch of largely valid critiques of the problems of modernity, but without, it was deconstruction, but without a new reconstruction for how to build. So then basically the only thing it can do is critique building, and which is a entropic direction. So the metamodern idea, which I'm sure everyone's familiar with, is there an epistemology that can take the relevant critiques of postmodernism and actually factor them into a better modernity or meta-modernity that is that has to be an integrated epistemology of how do we do production and building and towards what ends are actually meaningful? And so when I think of meta-modern Stoicism, I think of both to be able to solve any of the problems of the world right now, we need better participatory governance that can understand the problems and work on solutions at all. And the basis of that will be people that can make sense of reality better, make sense of each other's perspectives, and actually coordinate. Those are some initial thoughts since we started from a random place.
So, Maybe I'll start here. And for people listening, if you have questions, start throwing them in the chat box. Have like a question so I can fish for them, because there's a lot of comments in the chat box. You mentioned something when we were chatting on WhatsApp about what your current take was on how Stoicism is being presented today in the popular culture, and how it's being kind of repurposed by certain, I guess maybe masculine or self-help, help kind of gritted out type folks.
So the question is, do I have a critique of the modern presentation of Stoicism?
Either a critique on how modern Stoicism is presented, or just what your thoughts on how it's currently being presented.
I don't have that many. I don't feel like I know the current modern Stoic authors very well. I know a few things that seem like they have some elements right and some fairly superficial. One thing I'll say is that the superficial understanding of Stoicism that looks a little bit like logic over emotions and a kind of decrease of the value of emotion or emotional intelligence on one side, and then the kind of, let's call it trauma-aware perspective that pays more attention to what the effect of unexpressed, unfelt, unintegrated feelings are, shadow work, gestalt work, whatever. I would say that's a fake dialectic or a fake dichotomy. The two things that you don't ever want to do with emotions is immediately act out on them or repress them, right? And those are both dysfunctional activities. You want to be able to notice them arising and recognize they're arising for a reason that has signal for you to understand. There's actual intelligence and signal in every emotional response. So I want to be able to see it and really be with it and look at it, which I can't do if I'm shaming it or wishing it wasn't there. But for my own internal inquiry into my own wholeness, not immediately acting on it, to then see what is the right response. And sometimes the right response is to say that thing to that person. Sometimes the right response is to change the meaning I'm making, CBT style. Sometimes it's to recognize that an old trauma keeps getting triggered and being projected on current events, and I actually have to go work with that. Another part of how I think about the valuable thing that we can associate with Stoicism is a philosophy that asks, how can I relate to this in a way that increases my empowerment to relate to life with more agency? I think empowerment is, we can think about ennoblement, right? What are my virtues, and how do I, if I wasn't just asking what's in it for me, if I wasn't asking what is easy, and I was asking how would someone that I respect the most behave, what would that look like, and why is it that I respect that? So I'm mining my own value system, and then I'm noticing the delta between my value system and how I'm kind of conditioned to show up, and I'm asking how do I close that delta? That's a very deep, interesting inquiry. But as much as there is the kind of deepening virtue and ennobling, there's also the how do I relate to this in a way that empowers me, that I can continue to relate to life with more capacity to be in service to what I care about. And I think it's a very important question when it comes to emotions and difficulty of there's a kind of intelligence that is different than cognitive intelligence, which is kind of power intelligence or agentic intelligence. And if those aren't bound together, you can develop power that is not bound to virtue that ends up being quite destructive. But if you develop virtue that isn't bound to power, it's basically impotent. So how you have virtue, wisdom, power all co-developed in, so you're capable of service and know what you're in service to, is the thing that I think is actually interesting and worth exploring.
So we have a lot of questions now, so I'll pivot to the chat box, and I'll give everyone the opportunity to unmute themselves. So use this power with wisdom. Pranab, you had a question. If you can unmute yourself and ask it to Daniel.
Yeah. So, thanks for this talk. It's awesome so far. Let me scroll up to the question. So basically, what are some ways that you think metamodernism, or at least the epistemology behind metamodernism, can be taught or kind of encouraged within oneself, within dialogue with another person, or within scale, like at a community or society basis?
I'll share a few things, but it'll be more like a couple random smatterings than a comprehensive addressing of the pedagogy, because how I would answer that for kindergartners versus high schoolers and for people with different levels of investment and existing familiarity is obviously going to be quite different. But a couple things. In the academy, there has been this major divide most of the time between the liberal arts and the sciences, between something that orients more towards interpersonal intelligence versus, or intersubjective versus objective, empirical. But to make sense of society, you deeply need both working together. You need to be able to understand what other people believe, why they believe it, and what's the actual signal in that, and what base reality regarding objective things are. So to be oriented to both empiricism and being able to understand other people's narratives simultaneously is a key part. So some processes for how to do that. Take anything in the world that you're trying to sense make, or that someone's trying to sense make, and then try to help them with it. And one thing I would have them do is say, okay, find all the narratives that make sense of this that are out there. What are the primary narratives? It's like the mimetic tribes or kind of narrative generating clusters, right? So if I'm trying to make sense of the India-China war, or I'm trying to make sense of the BLM protests, there's obviously conspiracy narratives, far right, moderate right, Antifa, whatever. So I would try to generate the narrative landscape. So I say, what are the ways that different humans are making sense of this? And then I would try to steel man all the arguments. I would try to actually find the very strongest version of each of those narratives and make it as reify it as possible so that I really understand why they're understanding that and that I can look for the signal in it because there's never no signal. Then I would use some propositional logic and break the narrative into individual propositions, right? So a narrative is always that. So the bricks were put there by this for this purpose, the cops did this, whatever it is, break down the propositions. And then I would look for what evidence do those groups give to support each of the propositions and what sense can I make of that evidence and what additional evidence can I find? And I would seek to both try to verify and falsify each proposition. And then stepping while acknowledging that I might not be able to verify or falsify, I might just be able to say, this is a proposition for which I can't really ground it one way or the other at all. And all I can do is sit in some uncertainty and ask questions around where the burden of proof should be. So this is why Peter was talking about comfort with uncertainty earlier. If I'm not comfortable with uncertainty, then I'm going to rush to premature certainty and just be wrong about stuff. I have to be comfortable with uncertainty to be able to do the epistemics necessary to come up with appropriate certainty. But the comfort with uncertainty doesn't mean that I don't want increasing certainty, right? It doesn't mean that there isn't curiosity and an epistemic drive that wants to figure shit out. It's that I don't want to believe shit without having gone through the appropriate process to have the right calibrated confidence margin. It also means I never make what is most sacred to me attached to that belief system where now I can't change it, right? Because the confidence margin will always be less than 100%. This is the way I interpret the first verse of the Tao Te Ching saying, the knowledge that's knowable is not the eternal knowledge. The Tao that is speakable is not the eternal Tao. Your best, I might have a high confidence margin on something, but there's some shit that's in the unknown unknown that I'm not even aware I don't know about that could change the framing or the context of the whole thing. And if I make what is most sacred to me or my identity based on believing this thing because I have high confidence, I just became biased in a way that keeps me from being connected to life or learning. So I might have a high enough confidence to inform action, which I need, but I also need that I can ongoingly be able to change my mind. This is also how I take the Judaic, thou shalt have no false idols, and that every model of reality is an idol, right? Every model of reality isn't actually reality. So I'm going to construct a model that is a radical information compression and reduction on the actual reality that hopefully will be useful, but is never actually true. And when I know that, I don't ever make my model sacred, right? So I can always change and update my models. And I don't ever become destroyed when that happens because I actually have a relationship beyond cognition with myself and reality, right? What is sacred? What is the Tao? And a reverence for reality that if I'm ever wrong, I fucking want to see it, right? Because I want to be in the intimacy of being with reality as much as possible. So teaching people how to make sense of the current world by being able to see how everyone else makes sense of it, to really seek to take their perspectives and make their arguments well, and then to seek to do analysis on each of the parts, to calibrate confidence appropriately, to not pretend to have no bias, in which case your bias will just be hiding from you, but to take all the biases. I'm going to try to falsify this. Now I'm going to try to verify it so I can do both sides of a dialectic. And then to step back after the analysis and be able to look at the whole thing and say, what higher order perspectives are possible from looking at this whole thing? And what additional information would we need to be able to go further? This is one way of being able to help people learn how to think better. I could give lots and lots of examples. Like this becomes a very rich topic and we start to get into what should the future of education look like, but also what should the future of a civilization. Imagine that we built a civilization where the goal of it was evolving the humans in it maximally, right? And we had some congruent sense of what that was, where the nature of how work happened and how information was shared, how the algorithms on the internet were structured was towards that. It would be very interesting. Nora Bateson's warm data stuff is very good. I know she's coming on for helping people be able to understand complexity in a relatively simple way. Forrest's EGP, Forrest Landry's EGP, if that comes on, is a very good system to get people to ask much, much better questions, including questions that they didn't even know were things.
Thank you.
Just to piggyback on that, I'm designing a session for Rebel Wisdom on Friday, on Thursday, about mimetic mediation. And we're going to like play different videos of like Trump, AOC, all these political mimetic tribes, and then process it emotionally first before we inquire into the propositions. Do you think it's that, what the exercise that you mapped out about looking at the narratives, do you think that could also be repurposed for some kind of emotional integration work?
So there's a few ways that I would, noticing the emotions and giving some space to process them means that they won't be covertly hijacking your sense making because you've made them overt. So that's awesome, right? If I know that I'm angry or I know that I'm scared, I can actually look for how that's affecting my sense making. And in complex scenarios, it's very rarely like a simple equation how anything works. And all societal and ecology and psychology things are complex. It's usually that there's 100 different causal factors that are changing, and nexus causation. Enough stuff happens to move something across a threshold. So what happens, why two people who both have expertise in climate change and are earnestly trying to figure it out can come to such different senses or on immunity or anything complex, is because they weight the variables differently intuitively without realizing they're doing it. They recognize these are all variables, but their life experience has them weight some of them more than others. And so to notice our own weighting, that's where bias usually shows up. And the emotions are a very interesting way to start to be able to look at it. So if I'm looking at Trump and AOC and whatever, I might have emotion come up because of having adopted enough in-group, out-group type of stuff that I'm just responding with in-group, out-group, groupthink triggered kind of stuff. And I want to be able to, and this is why you actually have to have a virtue, the Stoicism kind of idea, you have to have a virtue that has you not just think that's a good idea, right? Because lots of people would be like, yes, I've accepted the in-group, out-group because my side is right and the other sides are wrong and fuck them. And like, this is time to pick sides and be strong and be at war. So to be able to say, hey, before having high certainty in anything, I want to actually make sure I'm taking all the biases and that I actually have clear understanding of the thing. I'm willing to take a stand on shit, but I want to make sure that I'm actually thinking and seeing clearly first. And I can't do that if I only have pejorative straw man versions of the other people, if I've never actually been able to sense why they would come to that in a way that isn't pejorative. So if you have a value around that, around St. Francis's seek first to understand before seeking to be understood, and then you will do the work towards it. So I might be emotional because of those reasons, and I get to see, oh, wow, I have bought into a particular chunk of rhetoric, right? Actually, there's a narrative warfare happening, and it won, and it captured me and made me a narrative soldier, and I thought I was choosing a free will, and not really, where those people's perspective strikes me as existentially risky so much that I can't listen to them, right? Them not being willing to wear masks means that they are science denying flat earth grandma killers and they're going to ruin everything, and or whatever it is, right? Them wanting to wear a mask means that they've bought into the pedo deep state and want to RFID chip my kids. And so I can't actually hear anything outside of that narrative frame that I've already accepted. So that's one thing the emotions might give me. Another thing they might give me that's even deeper is, okay, so I'm looking at homelessness or Amazon destruction or whatever, and I feel really fucking sad because the sadness is showing me something that's actually sacred to me. Or I'm angry or I'm afraid. Any of the negative emotions are actually showing me something sacred to me. The anger is I'm seeing something sacred and I'm looking at who's violating it. I'm focused on the blame side, but what the basis of it is there something I love and care about that if I didn't, there would be no emotional energy of anything I wanted to protect or that I cared was being harmed. I'd just be like, yeah, fuck it. Cut the Amazon down. I don't give a shit. I'm only angry because there's something I actually really care about. So if I trace the fear or the anger or the sadness back to what is it that is actually sacred to me that I'm trying to be in service of, that's a helpful piece of intelligence. Then I can say, okay, so I know what is sacred to me. I want to be in best service to it. Do I understand what is harming it or could harm it well enough that I can come up with solutions? If not, can I seek to understand better that I can actually be effective? And what way of relating to these emotions helps me be in most service? So if I hold the sadness in a way that decreases my agency, I just get overwhelmed and depressed and crippled, I'm actually not in service to what I care about. And so the Stoic, what is it that empowers me, is to say, if I actually care about that, the care can't be impotent, right? The love can't be impotent. It has to actually be able to act and be in service to what's cared about. So how can I relate to this that most empowers me to be in effective service towards what is sacred to me?
Yeah, that's really good. I dig that. Okay. Oh, man, so many questions. Benita Roy, you sent me a question privately. If you can unmute yourself and ask it to Daniel.
Hey, Bonnie.
Hi.
Good to see you.
So thank you for being you. My question is, where does this type of analysis and epistemic precision, what is the boundary of that? Does that fit? Obviously it fits in this world situation, but does it fit in your personal life? And how does that meld through? Because most of us don't have the kind of mind and the kind of capacity you have. And we want to take that part of what you're offering and meld that into our personal lives. Is that a question that you can understand so far?
Yeah. It's a great question.
Yeah.
I think it's most important for most people there, and actually easiest, because our personal life situations don't have the same level of complexity as all the things connected to climate change, fortunately. So we don't have to have expert level skills in 24 different fields to understand why our partner feels the thing they feel. So my personal life. Seek first to understand before seeking to be understood is as deep a piece of wisdom as anything I've ever heard. And it's not complicated. It's simple. It's only hard when the ego gets hijacked and really fucking wants to say what it wants to say. And so there has to be a value around, I actually don't want that hijacked ego place to get to run me. Now, I'm not going to, in order to be effective towards it, there are certain ways of repressing it that just make it worse. I want to actually be able to understand how it arises, why it arises, what its hooks are, how I work with those so that I can actually become more empowered. But ultimately, that's the place that when it talks, I feel regret and shame afterwards and need to apologize. There are other places that I feel the deepest kind of pride afterwards because I feel that I lived aligned with my own deepest values and there's more integration. I want to pay attention to which of those places is actually growing in its empowerment, which ones I'm feeding. And so my wife and I have a few guidelines that are very helpful. One is both people are never upset at the same time. And if so, we take a break. So that if she's upset, I don't go into my own emotional reaction on her emotional reaction where we're just spiraling and no one is actually clear to be able to bring it up, where then I'm not able to hear her. I'm just hearing how what she says is wrongly blaming me and what it means for me and whatever. There's no capacity in the relationship in that moment for good things to happen. So if she brings something up, I want to be able to come from enough wholeness that I don't instantly have to make it about me and I can actually hear her experience. And then I can help find out what does she need to be able to feel better, to feel heard, to return to center. And then if I have something I'd like to process afterwards, when she's clear and has capacity, I say, hey, can we talk about this? She's like, yeah. So, and oftentimes the thing that I wanted to say before seeking to understand, after I seek to understand, I don't even want to say because it was wrong. Or I understand where they were coming from enough that I have a different perspective on the thing.
being able to notice the place that wants to speak when out of center, and like the addiction that it is to want to do that, and to be able to just witness it. Like, you know, when you meditate and your nose itches and you don't itch it, there's this very helpful thing of just being able to say, I don't have to act on every sensation that arises. I can witness it. And I don't have to act on the sensation of I need to fucking be right and tell them why I'm right and whatever right now. I can just, if the thing I'm going to say is really true, it'll still be true tomorrow. If it is emotionality that will kind of blow over, well, then I can say, but only when I'm angry do I have the courage. Well, just choose to have more courage so that in a centered place, you'll still say the thing that is true.
So for me, I'm wondering, I mean, actually, this just came up now. It's like, I'm wondering if we could take what you just said, which was beautiful, see the pattern in it, and say that's the same pattern fractally at this larger scale, because it has deep feeling in that pattern. I have no idea what I'm saying right now, but like instead of like over here I'm like this and over here I'm like that, does this pattern somehow, I don't know.
Yeah. No, no, I like it, because there's a question of, is the thing that I'm describing at the macro scale kind of dry and sterile? Because in my relationship, it's not dry and sterile. It's very...
Yeah, I wouldn't say dry and sterile. I would say it's hyper-informed. So I'm not trying to be pejorative. It's hyper-informed. That's important. That's important. We need that. And I'm wondering where, like, the dance is between... Like, because in you, it's coherent. We know it's coherent because it's coherent in Daniel Schmattenberger. There's the evidence. You see what I'm saying?
Well, I think in terms of the significantly informed, like one way that I'll tell you an epistemic tool that I use to calculate confidence margins where it really matters. And this is like a set of formal systems from information theory. So I look at a situation and try to say how many orders of magnitude of interactions in the network diagram are occurring. If it's an ecosystem, maybe, you know, we have some basis of being able to say at what level of action. This is always hard because the question is, where's the boundary? Because I could say it's the whole fucking universe for everything, which is ultimately true. But I have to say, at which nexus mm-hmm. causation is being very significantly informed. I'm looking at what 10 to the 12 orders of magnitude of complexity in the situation or whatever. Then I want to look at the various hypotheses. Narrative is a set of hypotheses. I want to look at the various hypotheses and be able to say, what data do I have that supports it? And what do I have that either supports a mutually exclusive hypothesis or directly refutes it? And I want to take that down. I want to use information compression to say, what is the least number of bits in which I can represent that? So then I get to see the total unique pieces, the unique bits of information supporting the hypothesis, the unique bits of information refuting it, but also the total number of bits of information I have relative to the complexity of the scenario. So even if I have 10x more supporting than refuting, but the total amount of info I have is tiny relative to the complexity, my confidence will be low. So this sounds like a very logical process, which isn't necessarily what it feels like. And if I'm talking with my wife, right? But that's because the total amount of complexity in the situation with my wife is just not climate change, right? Like I actually want to be hyper-informed there. It's just easier, mm-hmm. right? I want to understand, what is she thinking? Why is she feeling that way? What brought it about? What needs feel unmet for her? What would actually feel meaningful? And so I'm seeking to be hyper-informed there. And it's not hyper-informed. I'm seeking to be adequately informed that I'm in touch with reality. And then once I'm like, oh, I get it. I get where she's coming from and I get why she feels the way she is and why she's expressing that. Then I feel like I can start to navigate. But I can't navigate when I don't have the map at all yet.
Yeah, so just so we're on the same page, hyper-informed is not a pejorative. Like, I think that's like, well, it could be, but for you, you're like hyper-informed, you put that book aside, and then you like act in a feeling sense. So I'm going to say something really crazy. Like, I don't even like what I'm going to say. Okay? So, what if we take that kind of action logics with your wife and put it to like ecology and the earth and have the ace in the hole, our hyper informed reality, which I actually think you do. Like, there's a kind of loving of the earth and the life force. That's more like the action logics you have with your wife. And then you have this hyper-informed. What if we could communicate that?
I think that's the point, right?
Yeah.
I see that all in you. Well, I mean, in all of us, when we were talking about binding wisdom, virtue, and power, that's almost like three chakras, depending upon how you want to define it, right? And you could take the chakra system or any ancient system that was trying to explore this as, like, if I think about the piece of Hindu artwork, if I think about the Hindu chakra system as each of them representing a different type of intelligence, the growth of the person was to develop all of them and all of them in relationship with each other. So the whole being could be in a full relationship with the whole of reality. And so there's a different kind of intelligence, like and whether they actually have any relationship to parts of the body because of endocrine glands or nerves doesn't matter, to at least have it be a metaphorical system. But the will or the power, there's a kind of intelligence to say, what way of me relating to this most increases my capacity to serve what I care about, right? There's a kind of intelligence that's asking that is different than asking, what am I able to falsify or verify about objective reality, which is also different than the kind of intelligence of asking, or here, how would I communicate this in a way that would land for someone? And in order to have it land for them, I have to actually be them. Right? There's a kind of empathy built in that I have to be them to know how it land, or try to, which is different than what is most sacred to me. And so I think what we're interested in is, how do we develop whole people that have all of their intelligences online and all of them working together, analysis and synthesis, logic and intuition, and then that are in relationship with all of reality. There aren't race issues and environmental issues and economic issues, there's reality issues where all of those things are inextricably interconnected and interconnected to the being of all the other people. And when we have increasingly whole people and in increasingly integrous relationships with the wholeness of reality, we start getting much better processes. I think that's related to what you're saying.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bonnie. That was really fun.
Thank you, Benita, as always. David, you had a question that got up lots of plus ones, if you can unmute yourself and ask it.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Daniel. I wanted to keep this question kind of a little bit broad and vague, and that is just around, so Daniel, you had an experience being psychological guide and support. And you saw these people presenting their view of their small world and the big world. And that sounded like that informed your own growing awareness and investigations at the time. And I'm curious if the neurodivergence that you would have seen in your patients or just in friends informed you in any way. And if you could speak to that.
The neurodivergence in particular, as opposed to...
Mm-hmm. So in the sense that I imagine someone can come across Stoicism at an early age and develop with that framework in mind, and then someone might be further along the spectrum and that might also influence their information uptake, or whatever you want to call it.
So are you asking how much people were able to grow and change and develop based on what types of previous experience?
Yes to that, but also more to the point of, in the case of, say, autism or something like that, where we have this awareness of a spectrum, how much did you see that impact their awareness of this reality that you personally also see? And then also their ability to latch onto different information as well.
Yeah, clearly not everyone is equally capable of every kind of process. And there is development that everyone can do, and everyone is not even equally capable of every type of development, right? Like Down syndrome is a real thing that affects capability in certain ways. Autism is kind of interesting because autism is not the spectrum that we have now, where such a high percentage of people are considered somewhere on the spectrum as a relatively new evolutionary phenomena. I don't think is evolutionary. I think it's cultural and environmental. And in some ways it just represents lack of development, like not having like we can look at all the physiologic dynamics, right? We can look at ubiquitous sugar and psych meds starting early and things that damage the microbiome and glyphosate and ubiquitous mold toxins and whatever that are the result of, you know, post-industrialized life and say, there's actual physiologic elements that have happened, but there's no one for one thing. It is basically a much more complex set of dysregulations of homeodynamics that express in a dysregulated nervous system. That's true. There's also, let's say it's people growing up as digital natives with a lot of screen time, where they're getting much faster dopaminergic hits from activities that are decoupled from the movement of their body and decoupled from accomplishing things in an evolutionary sense. It starts to actually mess up the nature of the dominance and process of neurotransmission. There's a lot of things that go in. There's also like that's actually an example of things that would develop certain capacities just being underdeveloped because they're not actually having a culture or an upbringing that develops some of those things. So for instance, if I have, like, this is a common understanding, but if I have toys that do fucking everything and I'm not making a stick into certain toys and a rock into certain toys, there's certain kinds of creativity that don't develop because I don't actually have, I have so much external other market creativity that is just creating dopaminergic response. I don't have to do curiosity, creativity, and exploration to find my own. So there's a lot of places where the world structure is simply not developing shit in people that it needs to. I also think that there's, you know, we can think about development from an individual perspective and also from a group selection perspective. And the idea that everyone is going to evolve to the highest stages of development on all lines of development is just silly. That's just not going to happen. And in the same way that not everyone is going to become masterful at every language and every scientific discipline and every musical instrument. And so there's also a question around, like, what is the minimum competence of certain kinds of capacities that are needed to engage as a citizen, where then I can be part of a collective intelligence that orients that the people who are best at different things are able to differentially contribute to those things. I don't know if that addressed the question, because the question, as you said, was kind of broad. I'm happy to take another step at it if you want.
I think that did address the question. I mistakenly forgot to include how something like stoicism might impact the path that these people might take and your own thoughts around that. And maybe if you could speak to your own experiences in, I can't remember if it was counseling or more clinical psychology.
The people that are obviously clearly functional and just define themselves as mildly on the spectrum or mildly Aspie, which is it's basically an increasingly large identifier for things that really should not be considered a disease diagnosis. It's just people who kind of suck at certain things or who never learn something or who just are introverted or whatever. But the patterns that we think of as kind of mildly Aspie, one way you could think of them is low capacity for nuance. We can talk about it as low empathy and interpersonal recognition, but a major part of it is for nuance. So they usually end up becoming very good at things that are black and white, like whether it's computer programming or mechanical engineering or things like that. And so Stoicism implemented without nuance can be pretty clunky and messed up, just like any, because the eternal Tao cannot be spoken, the version that I speak will be wrong. And so I can write down here are the virtues and here's the code of behavior. And then someone else who doesn't really get the spirit of it, they're getting the letter of the law without the spirit of it, will implement it in a fundamentalist righteous kind of way without being able to understand in Ecclesiastes when it said there's a time to kill and a time to heal and to sow and to reap and for every purpose under heaven. Well, how do I know which time it is for which of the things? Well, there is no absolute algorithm for that. That's being able to use all of those types of intelligence with full presence and discernment to a set of values that can't be formally explicated. There's a Gödel's theorem here where what is meaningful is beyond formal explication. But there, if I have a formal explication, it'll work lots of times, but then there'll be a place at which I'm like, no, that's actually wrong. What is it in me that can recognize when the code is wrong? That's the thing we want to be developing in people, which is their actual capacity for discernment. And where people don't have that as much, we want to be developing it. Where there's upper bounds for physiologic reasons, then we would want a good society that puts them in roles that get to, or supports them to be in roles that get to utilize the capacities they do have well without being damaged by the ones that they don't.
Thank you, Daniel. That fit with my thoughts around that as well. Thanks.
All right. Hannah, you had a follow-up question. I will paste it again in the chat box.
Yeah. So I wanted to look at this topic from another angle. I am an anxious person and I have panic attacks. So hearing a lot of language that I think has developed from looking at things like triggered and limbic states and so on, makes me wonder, will it be more challenging for me to learn these sorts of skills, or maybe will my familiarity with things like panic attacks actually be helpful here? And, you know, what is going to be a good way for people like me to approach this?
Beautiful question. I used to have panic attacks. Had a period where that was quite debilitating and didn't sleep for quite a long time. And so I understand. Early I had a completely debilitating fear of public speaking where I just couldn't, like I would pass out if I tried. I only found one thing that actually really worked for panic attacks. And by worked, I mean actually changed the underlying reality fundamentally as opposed to managed it. I didn't find that CBT did, or DBT, or hitting pillows, or emotional release therapy, or gestalt, or hypnotherapy, like those were all cool, but or breath work, or meditation, or the only thing that I found worked was there are different ways of doing it, but there are ways that go into the panic attack as opposed to away from it. And so I'll explain the mechanism here briefly. A panic attack is different than just generalized anxiety, right? It's generalized anxiety that turns into a feedback loop. And so let's say that I'm anxious about some shit. Everybody's anxious, like that fear is a natural part of life, and we'll feel some adrenaline happen. And we know that that's because in evolutionary environments, the fear usually needed a physiologic response. So some adrenaline would come so I could run or fight or something. Now, most of the things I'm afraid of don't actually need adrenaline because I'm not going to have a physical response to if the teacher likes my report, or if the person on the date wants to respond or not. And as a result, I don't use up that adrenaline. There isn't a kind of adaptation. It just feels shitty, right? And so maybe I'm in a situation where I have a relationship that's going bad and I'm not sure if it's going to work or not. And I'm not sure if they're being honest to me. And then finances are also tight, and then something else. And I start to have more base anxiety. So my base anxiety gets high enough. And then maybe at a certain point, something happens and my base anxiety is high enough that the sensation of it inside of me, the fluttering in my stomach or the like hotness in my ears or in my face, all of a sudden is a sensation that I'm unfamiliar with. Like it's at a higher level. And all of a sudden I get scared of that sensation because I'm like, what's happening? Am I dying? What's like, am I going crazy? What the fuck's happening? Now, when I get afraid of my own experience of fear, now I'm in a feedback loop because I'm not afraid of reality. I'm afraid of my own experience of fear. So my body produces adrenaline to the symptoms of adrenaline. And that tight feedback loop is a motherfucker because sometimes it'll just produce adrenaline to the symptoms of adrenaline. So then the symptoms get worse. So then you get more scared, and it does that until you just run out of adrenaline and eventually pass out, or you go get a benzo or an alcohol or something. If I try to do breath work to calm it, which of course to some degree I can, because I can take breaths that stimulate my parasympathetic nervous system and are inverse to a sympathetic drive. And if I try to distract myself with bunny videos or whatever I would do to try to create a different response, I'm still affirming that I'm scared of that sensation and that I don't want it to happen. And that if it comes, I'll be scared of it. So my sympathetic adrenal complex is still oriented to produce adrenaline to my symptoms of adrenaline. So I'm always scared of that thing happening. So there are processes where you get facilitated to go into the panic attack fully. And so you start to think about things you're anxious of, you start to feel the symptoms, and then you start to say, it's important to know that it can't kill you. Even if you feel like you can't breathe, at worst you pass out, the panic attack is gone and your conscious mind isn't there, you start breathing again. So you know this is just sensations, and as uncomfortable as they are, they can't actually hurt me. They're just fucked up feeling, but sensations. And you're like, ultimately, I want to understand myself. I want to understand what's arising enough that I can actually be with myself and have more wholeness. So then you start to go into a process where you say, all right. And typically I would say this should be facilitated, and I can recommend processes that do that. So you go into a process where you're being facilitated to notice the symptoms, the rapid heart, the flushing face, and rather than want them to go away, welcome them. Say, I welcome all of this. I want to feel it. In fact, I want to feel the fullness of it. I want to understand all of it and be with all of it. So not only do I want to feel it, I want it to get as intense as it can. So you actually welcome it to let the heart racing get more intense, the difficulty breathing getting more intense. And you can't say it while actually really wishing it goes away. You have to really lean in as an explorer, as a curious explorer, to be like, what is this? When that happens, there is a clear signal to your adrenals that you're not afraid of the thing you're leaning into, and it stops producing adrenaline in response to the symptoms of adrenaline. There is a kind of HPA axis neurological reset, psychological reset as well. And then once you've done that several times, you start to be like, actually, I'm not afraid of this thing. I can lean into it. I'm not going to die. I'm not going to go crazy. I can, and the feelings are actually whatever, right? They're not that terrible. And then the key becomes, well, you'll be afraid for it to come on at certain times. Like, I don't want it to come on when I'm having to give my talk or with my work or whatever it is. So then you actually have to welcome that it can come anytime, because otherwise the time that it isn't welcome is when you'll still be in that response and be like, okay, if it comes at that time, I'll be with it. I'll go into it. I'll be with it, because what the fuck else am I going to do? Like, I don't really have much any other good choices. And this is the process of leaning in and actually befriending the fear. So fear stops being a self-reinforcing loop. Anyone who goes through that and actually goes through it will have both a level of compassion and humility plus a level of strength that is not really available if people haven't gone through it.
Any follow-up question, Hannah?
Many follow-up thoughts. that I will process slowly over time. Thank you, Daniel. That was really useful.
Panicaway.com is a site that has some good information on a process like this. And that they may even have a list of practitioners. And this is a big part of Stoicism, of wanting to really be with reality and lean into it. So contemplating death, leaning into anxiety. But it's not to just feel shitty all the time. It's that you actually stop feeling shitty when you stop running away from parts of yourself. One good way to talk about healing is increasing wholeness. And the dysfunctional ways that some people interpret Stoicism are things that make them actually fragment, less whole. They're ashamed of a part of themselves without knowing why that part's arising. No, I shouldn't feel angry. I shouldn't feel jealous, repress that. And so as a result, they're actually stuffing shit into the shadows and they're becoming more fragmented and less whole. A healthy relationship, stoically, is to say, I want to understand why that's arising, what it is, so that I can incorporate it into a wholeness of self.
All right. We're approaching the allotted 75 minutes. Do you have time for one more question, Daniel? Or
yeah.
Cool. So who was that one that got a lot of plus ones? Alex, you had a really good question. If you can unmute yourself and ask it to Daniel.
Yeah. Hey, everyone. So the question is, Daniel, I've heard you speak about how those with the greatest depth of care often are not good at or are not interested in impacting the world at scale or sort of doing what's needed to accumulate power. Could you paint a vision for how a wise, empathic person might orient to accumulating power in the world?
I'll share how this first occurred to me was when I was a kid. I was engaged in part of the homeschooling thing was I kind of got to do the things I was interested in. I was interested in all types of activism. So I was doing animal rights stuff with PETA and environmental stuff with Greenpeace and human rights stuff with Amnesty International, because it seemed like a meaningful life was in service to all other life was pretty straightforward. As I was trying to figure the philosophy out, that part seemed clear. And so all of the different types of suffering bothered me and injustices and whatever. But I was also studying the sciences because I wanted to understand reality better. And so I would have conversations with scientists who would work at military industrial complex type places. And I would get a sense of the types of technology and sophistication they were working with, but then advancing what types of agendas. And then be with the protesters who were willing to undergo great harm to themselves to stand up for what they cared about, whether they were handcuffing themselves to an old redwood to not have it cut down or whatever. But I got to see that like picket signs and handcuffs were the extent of the strategic capacity that they had compared to NSA being the largest employer of mathematicians and supercomputing technology and whatever. And I was like 10 or something when I'm like, this is the head-heart divide at the level of humanity and we go extinct as long as those who care the most have shitty tools for actuation and those who have the best tools for actuation are doing it for narrow and divisive ends. And then a little bit later, I started to think of it as at least three things, that it was kind of mind, heart, will. And that any two of them didn't really matter, that there was the development of will. I feel like I can do something and I'm willing to work hard to do it. And values or care or compassion together that led to an activist who really cared about stuff and was totally willing to work effectively, but didn't have good strategy and would just basically fail at scale every time. Then there were people who had development of mind and heart more, but with less will, where they felt like they understood the problems, they really cared, but they were kind of like overwhelmed, crippled academics, or at best could be advisors to powerful people that would never actually take their advice. And then there was kind of will and mind together, but without development of compassion and virtue. And those were the very effective, sociopathically oriented people that ran the world. And it was clear to me that you had to have at least all three of those well developed, plus the interpersonal capacity to find other people that had those developed and coordinate together to really be able to change the trajectory of the world. And so this comes down to this whole thing of not being willing to suck at being in service to what I care about. If I see the Amazon burning or Northern California burning, and I see the Redwoods burning, and that really bothers me, and I am willing to continue to be useless towards it, then I have to be like, does it really bother me? Do I really care? What is the fragmentation inside of myself? What does my care mean if it doesn't predispose the behavior of my life? What is my life in service to if not what I care about? Oh, distraction or money or whatever else. I don't actually even care about what I care about. I'm just full of shit. Okay, that's the internal fragmentation. What does it mean to care about what I care about? It means that my dollars and minutes will express what I care about. Then I'm acting on it, but I keep failing. Well, then I need to look at my strategy and say, why do I keep failing? And unfortunately, a lot of times people will work hard, fail, and just assess that Goliath is too big or there aren't enough people helping or whatever, and are happy to come up with excuses why they aren't effective rather than really say, what would it take to be effective? Because neither the CCP nor the CIA nor the Kremlin just give up and say, oh, I guess we're not effective. The other guys are bigger. They like keep figuring out how to be more effective towards their ends. And they can move trillions of dollars in standing armies and the mindsets of people and technology as a whole. If we want a better world, we have to be able to affect the world at that level, aligned with a different value system. So what I would say is we aren't in, like, Game B isn't a thing really yet. It's at most kind of an idea. We live in a world that is dominated by power. And the transition from this world to a different kind of world system that might have a very different culture and governance is only going to happen if some people who are authentically oriented to a different world system learn how to effectively move this one and move in this one effectively.
Thank you. And I realize we're past time, so you could either not answer this or be brief with it. But I think a follow-on question that occurs to me is I read your piece about the sort of the polymath bodhisattva world creator as sort of archetypes that represent mind, heart, will. And I feel like I have a sense of sort of characters or developmental pathways that correspond with becoming a polymath, becoming a bodhisattva. But I think what's less clear and what's kind of relevant to this question is this notion of the archetype of a world creator. What does that mean, and what kinds of developmental pathways or traditions are relevant to that?
So look at people who were not born into great wealth or power and became very powerful, and study their biographies, specifically the biographies of their psychology and the steps they took. And what'll be interesting is you'll be studying Genghis Khan and Alexander the Great and Napoleon and Carnegie and Elon Musk and whomever. And you'll be like, how the fuck would I apply some of those actually kind of dreadful game theoretic tactics to something better? But that's just a kind of a very superficial assessment. As you go deeper, you're like, how did they empower themselves not coming from it? What were the things that did that? And what would it look like to be able to do that towards a different set of goals? There's a whole big conversation here, but look at people who increased their agency radically, and then look at the commonalities of what is involved in increasing agency.
Thank you.
Cool. So we're going to end it here. That was a really awesome session. Someone wrote in the chat that the session really feels like the Stoa, and I totally agree. So yeah, thank you, Daniel, for coming out today to talk about metamodern Stoicism. Any kind of thoughts you'd like to share before I do some announcements?
I just love that there's a space where these conversations are happening, and I'm glad to have got to be here. And I know we have another one coming up soon.
Yeah. Yeah, so we'll start plugging the upcoming events. So the one next Monday, the same time, 7:30 p.m. Eastern time, is Daniel's coming back to do a session on Dharma inquiry. So he had these like freaking awesome questions. And I was like, what is this? And then all these people that I know are doing the questions like, you know, by themselves. I'm like, you know what? Maybe Danny would like to do a session. So would you like to maybe speak on that a little bit to get people have a sense of it?
I wrote the questions because they're questions that come up when I'm talking to people all the time, where people have a desire to have to figure out what their path is, what a more meaningful life for them is. And so there is no, again, algorithm for it, but these are questions that help me kind of get a sense of that for people. And so anyone can just look at that and do it on their own. But what we're going to talk about is unpacking, like, when I look at those questions, why those questions? What is the generator function that leads to the questions to be able to have a sense of other questions? And like, what am I looking for and interpreting to get a sense of the uniqueness of someone's path?
Mm-hmm. Very cool. So people are asking where they can find these questions. If you go to the website, thestoa.ca, and you go RSVP to that event, the questions are linked in that. And I think, you know, there might be sessions that come from these questions because they're so rich and it takes some time to get through them. Okay, so tomorrow we have some cool events. Jeremy Johnson is coming in tomorrow to do a session critiquing, let me read it for you. Transcending the Cancel Culture Critique, an Integral Left Response. So I released this piece on the Cancel God and some Integral Leftists were critiquing it. So I'm inviting in Jeremy Johnson in for a good faith critique on that. That's 12 p.m. Eastern time. And then Travis Macy, an ultra marathon endurance athlete. He's coming in to talk about the ultra mindset. Think of like David Goggins, but like a more indie version. So that's going to be pretty cool. That's 6:30 p.m. Eastern time. You know, we have some facilitators here. Benita's back. Do you want to plug the Hollow Sense Making in Residence series that you have coming up in October? Maybe she didn't hear. Okay, I'm maybe putting her on her spot. Benita, can you hear? I was asking you to plug the your Hollow Sense Making Sense Maker in Residence.
Okay. Sorry, I was out and I just came back. So the hollow is the word hollow, like the legend of Sleepy Hollow, is a like a riverine place where people gathered in secret to talk about changing the world. And for me, it's also about hollow in the sense that the Dzogchen or the Buddhist notion of emptiness, like we're hollow, we're participatory and hollow, and also Halloween and the other worlds we can access. So yeah, I don't know. I really like that notion of hollow. This sense of moving from campfire, like, which is kind of jovial, to the hollow, which is secretive and dark and riverine. That's kind of like what we wanna launch.
And you're talking to Nora Bateson and Aria Beck too on this Thursday, I think.
Yeah, we're going to talk about, I think the energy there is like, can people stop thinking in terms of linear cause and effect? Like, and then how does that percolate into personal life? Like no if then thinking, and how can that inform emergence? And that should be really exciting.
Yeah, it's gonna be
a lot of energy, a lot of energetics there.
And so that the Hollow series, Benitez, a sense maker in residence at the Stoa for October. We have John Robb, Dave Snowden, Zach Stein, Peter Wang, Daniel Gertz is coming in as well to be a sense maker for residence for the months of September, October. Those are four sessions throughout a month. So you can go on the website, RSVP there. Rachel Haywire, maybe we'll let you plug the last event. You got the Philosopher Queens. Maybe you and Raven can both plug it if you guys are here. Rachel Haywire. Raven Connolly.
Hi, everybody.
You did. You go first.
Hey, Rachel, you want to go for it? Talk about Philosopher Queens?
Yeah, okay. So Philosopher Queens are the dark, powerful feminine force that is resurfacing as a new current. I felt a little bit of that energy just from what Benita was saying when she was talking about the depth and the hollow and the expansion. I definitely felt a little bit of that energy there. So Raven and I are hosting a series here at the Stoa in which we engage with one another and the people that come to the panel, and we talk about this current. We talk about other women, other philosopher queens of history and of the present, and we bring in people to talk with them. So we're unifying the dark goddesses.
Cool. And Raven, you want to plug your Socratic speed dating real brief?
Sure. So so Socratic speed dating happens every Friday at the Stoa. It's a tradition that Peter and I started way early back in the beginning of the pandemic, where people can come from all aspects of the kind of Stoa ecosystem and talk in breakout rooms that go for about 15 minutes, and it's all spurred by a collective intelligence of question generation that we do as a group. So that's, every Friday, come join if you wanna have some personal conversation with all the Stoa faces. Thank you.
Very, very cool, thank you. So if you wanna continue this conversation, we finally have a Discord. You can go there, that's the invite, the post-sense making session, that's the channel to do it. And if you'd like to support what the Stoa is doing, we've done about over 300 events since the pandemic to address mental health crisis, the meta crisis, the meaning crisis. So you can do that on the Patreon page right there. That being said, we're going to stop recording. We'll have a moment of bio break, and then our boy Tyson Wagner is going to get some freestyling on. So if you're interested in that, you can just stay on this link. So thanks, everyone, and thank you, Daniel.